Genesis chapter 45, verse 3 reads, "And Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?' But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence." Some translations use the word troubled or terrified to describe the position of Joseph's brothers. The Hebrew word more paints a picture, if you will, that means to tremble on the inside. We would say shaking in your boots. The brothers looked like a cat had their tongue, if you will, and they were shaking in their boots at the revelation that the man that stands before them, the one who has all of this power to decide their fate, is their brother. And if you know the history of the relationship between Joseph and his brothers and how they saw him last, not as a 39-year-old powerful man in the nation of Egypt, but as a 17-year-old boy who was distraught and crying out, it would make sense that they would be shaking in their boots. Genesis 37 gives us a little overview of the history that the brothers had together and their final farewell before this great revelation that's shared before them. And so I want to read just a few verses from chapter 37 so that we could appreciate the dismay, the terror, the troubled sense that Joseph's brothers have about them as they stand before him, recognizing that this is their brother. Genesis 37, verses 2 through 4, give us a picture of the tension. "Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons, because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him." Now the verses in this story go on to let us know that Joseph had a couple of dreams, and he tells his brothers these dreams, and in the dreams, the brothers are bowing down before Joseph. Well, they hated him already, so these dreams didn't make it any better, right? They just hated him even more to the point that they would conspire to kill him. And so Joseph is sent out by his father to check on his brothers while they're pasturing in the fields. It seems like the father didn't catch a clue that the brothers really didn't like him. So he sends him out by himself to go see how they're doing. And the brothers see Joseph coming. And verses 18 through 20 tell us their thoughts as they see the brother who they hate completely coming to meet them. It says in verse 18 of 37 in Genesis, "They saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, 'Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams.' But a brother, Reuben, convinced them not to kill him, to just throw him into a pit. And then he was going to come back and rescue him later, but it didn't go according to plan." And so we see in verses 24 through 27 what would be their final farewell to their brother. Verse 24 reads, "And they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat. And looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, 'What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh.' And his brothers listened to him." So now, oh, this is our brother, so we won't kill him. We'll just do him a favor and we'll sell him into slavery. What great brotherly love that they had for Joseph. And so this is the last time they saw their 17-year-old brother who they hated. They see him being carried off by this caravan into slavery to Egypt. And now they're standing before him, a 39-year-old grown man who is powerful and who could decide their fate. It's no wonder that they're troubled, terrified, dismayed, that they can't speak a word. It's not, "Hey, Joseph, it's so good to see you. It's been 22 years. Where you been?" No, that wasn't the response. It was dumbfounded. Joseph. They couldn't put it all together. And so they're stuck and they're shaking. And naturally, one would say, well, they have every right to be terrified because Joseph is about to drop the hammer. Right? Joseph, one would expect, would respond to them the way that he responded or the way they responded to him. You wanted to sell me into slavery? Now I'll send you into slavery as well. But what we'll see in this passage is Joseph didn't respond to his brothers with cruelty. Instead, he showed compassion. He didn't look to crush them. Instead, he looked to care for them. And what would cause Joseph to have that kind of response? We'll see that as we look in verses 4 through 8a, as Joseph engages with his brothers who are standing there dumbfounded and shaking in their boots. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near. And he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God." Joseph is talking to his brothers and telling them, don't be distressed. Don't be angry with yourselves for what you did. It's all right. What would cause Joseph to have that kind of response to his brothers? Joseph's perspective was based on his purpose and not the pain that he endured. See, Joseph wasn't looking at his brothers and treating them based on what they did to him. If he did, then naturally, prison, life sentence. But no, Joseph says here, don't be distressed, don't be angry, because God has sent me here with purpose. And because of Joseph's purpose, he has a different perspective, and that causes him to respond to his brothers with grace, love, and mercy. And Joseph says his purpose is to preserve life. There's a significant famine in the land. It's going to last 7 years. It's only been 2 years. There are another 5 years. No plowing, no harvesting. So not only are you not going to take something out the ground, it's going to be so dry, you're not going to put anything into the ground either. So there's no chance of a hope that you're going to have food over the next 5 years. But don't worry. God sent me here with purpose. And so I'm not here to now judge you, because I've been sent by God to preserve you. Joseph was so convinced that God sent him with purpose that he didn't want his brothers to get any credit for his Egyptian excursion. He didn't say, "Hey, thanks a lot. You all got me right on the path and sent me along my way." No. Joseph wanted to give God all the glory for what was happening in Egypt. And so Joseph says in verse 8, we see it, "So it was not you who sent me here, but God. God sent me here." And don't be mistaken, Joseph is not ignorant to what happened. I mean, we just read it. He knows, don't be angry that you sold me. So he remembers that they sold him, but because of the purpose for which God sent him, Joseph is communicating that God's purpose trumps man's plans. So I see all of my life not based on what you're doing to me or what you have done to me, but what God has purposed for me. So I'm not going to give man the credit for what's been done. I'm going to give God the glory for what he has done. God sent me. He sent me here. And he sent me with a purpose. And Joseph didn't just believe that God sent him with purpose. Joseph was also fully persuaded that God perfectly worked out a process to put him in a position to partner with his creator in seeing the promise come to pass. You go ahead and try and say that many P's real fast. I assure you, you will stumble. You got to slow down when you're going to say that many P's. So we see in verse 8b how Joseph truly believed that God didn't just send him with purpose, but that God also was able to work out this process so that Joseph can be used to see the people of God preserved in this famine. The word reads, "He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt." Joseph is saying that God brought me here, and then over the next 22 years while I was here, God raised me up to the position of power that I am in. Joseph is now the most powerful person in the most powerful nation in the known world at this time. He is only second to power to Pharaoh, and that's just in the throne. Other than that, Joseph has full reign. Everybody comes to Joseph to know what they're gonna do. Everybody comes to Joseph to see how much food they can get. Joseph has full reign. Pharaoh doesn't check in. Joseph is running the show. And Joseph believes that it was God who raised him up to this position to be in a place of power so that he can preserve his people during the famine. Now, we can't miss the implications of Joseph's conviction. What Joseph is stating here is that God sent him back when he was 17 years old to Egypt, and that he raised him up to be in the palace to preserve his people. But if we understand the story right, when God sent Joseph at 17 years old to Egypt, that was 20 years before the famine ever came. So Joseph believed that God initiated this plan 20 years before Israel and all his children even knew that there was a problem that needed a plan to be resolved. God initiated his plan. And then God strategically worked the process to make sure that his plan came together perfectly. So at the designated time, Joseph was in place at 39 years old, 22 years later, saying, "Bring all your people. Bring them all. I'm going to provide for your children and your children's children so that you do not come to poverty." Now, it's at this point in the story where that is absolutely beautiful. That's a mind-blowing thought. And at the same time, it's befuddling. I mean, wait a minute. I mean, that's beautiful that God could initiate this plan 20 years before man even knew there was a problem. But at the same time, I can't wrap my mind quite around the thought that God executed perfectly his plan over the last 22 years so that the people of God can be preserved. And there's a reason why we would get stuck in our logical thinking, because we know that we do not have that capability. I mean, at best, we don't know the future. We'll forecast, right? Which is why we pay people six figures, weather forecasters, financial forecasters. They tell us what they think may happen, and we'll trust that. Right, many of you probably last night or maybe this morning woke up and looked at your weather app or looked online to see what the weather was going to be. 30% chance of rain. And it's going to be 40 degrees. So what do? Well, you grab an umbrella. You put on a coat. And then you go outside. And at the end of the day, you carry this umbrella all day. And you think to yourself, man, it didn't rain. They said 30%. That means there's a 70% chance that it won't, right? But we will base our lives off of this forecasting. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with meteorology. I appreciate their craft. But at the best they could do is forecasting. We don't guarantee this. And we don't hold them accountable to that. Wait a minute. I'm going to write my news station. You said it was a 50% chance of rain, and there wasn't even a sprinkle that hit the ground. No one does that, right? Because they're just forecasting, financial forecasters. They'll tell you, put your money into these stocks. But they'll give you a forecast based on what was, based on what is trending right now, and how they think things may go. But because they know they don't have a clue, they tell you to diversify your portfolio, right? put it here. Coke has been looking strong, but you know, they got this report now that sugar's not good for you, so Coke can tank. You want to put a little bit over here as well, right, just in case. Right, they're forecasting. And we understand that, so we diversify our portfolio. We don't have this expectation that man would be able to plan out a future for a problem that they don't even have a clue about. We don't have that expectation. We just forecast. But God doesn't have to forecast because he foreknew. See, God already knows what is and what will be. Because God is not like man. He's not like us. He's not trying to figure out what does it look like based on what it was. No, see, God is eternal. He is without beginning or end. He is the great creator, the creator of all things, including time. And while God is gracious to enter into his creation, he is not bound by that which he has created. Right, so God knows what is to come. Again, in him, it's not, oh, well, that's the future. No, for God, the future is past. I know, it's right, see, there it goes. It's like, that's beautiful, but it's also befuddling. Like, wait a minute, you said, so in my present, that's God's past, and in my future, that's God's present, or it's God's past. Because it's hard really to wrap your mind around totally because we are not eternal. But Jesus tells us a little bit to maybe help us understand it a little more in the book of Revelation. As Jesus was talking to John about his return, he speaks of himself, and this is how Jesus talks about himself. He says, I am the Alpha and the Omega. Alpha was the first letter in the Greek alphabet, and Omega is the last. But he builds on this, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. In other words, time has its stamp in God, right? Because he is before and he is after. He has always been. He always will be. Everything exists within him. He's not trying to figure out the future. He already knew the ending before the beginning knew to begin. He already had it all figured out. He's not trying to work it out. He's not trying to look and say, I think with the southeasterly wind, that storm system could just, oh, nope, it changed. No, he knows, right? There's no 20% chance of rain. If God says it's going to rain, take your umbrella. But it looks so bright and sunny. I don't see a cloud in the sky. God says it's going to rain. I don't feel like it's going to rain. Up, there it goes. It's raining. It's 100% chance because God is already present in the future. The future exists in him. And while that could be a little confusing, I think Paul clears it up just a little bit in Colossians chapter 1. Allow me to read verse 16 and 17. For by him being Jesus, all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things. And in him, all things hold together. In God, all things hold together. And he isn't waiting for some new information. Because he is without beginning and without end, he has all the information that he needs. I've been teaching my boys how to play chess. And now, you know, they've gotten a little bit better. And sometimes they actually may win a game or two. And they actually win because I don't believe in letting kids win anything. You're going to earn that victory. So they actually beat me from time to time. And it's beautiful to watch because when you're playing chess, right, you're thinking through, you're strategizing, right? You know you're a really good chess player when you could think three moves ahead. And then you think through those moves because you're setting your opponent up. And then you think through the possible counters that they may make, and you counter their potential counters in your head. I mean, you really got to think through this thing. It's not checkers. You don't just go, ooh, ooh, ooh. No, you really have to think through it and work. You got to work hard, right? So you're playing this chess game. You're watching. You're like, man, I knew you were going to make that move. And then after a while, you're like, checkmate. Man, you set me up. I know I did. And it feels good when you set them up and you win, right? It doesn't feel good when they set you up and win. But you think that you've done something good because you've thought through their possible moves and you've worked out your moves and you're thinking ahead and you're strategizing. Well, it'd be no fun playing chess with God. I mean, it's like, God, you already know the game. Just checkmate. You didn't even start. Just lay your king down. You know, I didn't even move a pawn, right? God knows all the moves already. He's not thinking ahead and trying to counter your counter. No, no, he uses all things to work together for his good, right? And so that's why Joseph would say, I know that you meant this for evil, but God meant it for good. I know you thought that you were getting rid of me to stop the dream from happening, but you are a participant in God's plan. Listen, there are only two positions that you'll take in the plan of God. You're either a willing participant or you're an unwilling participant, but you're going to participate in God's plan coming to pass. I'm going to tell you right now, so you might as well bow down while you can on your own volition, because at some point, every knee's going to bow, every tongue's going to confess. See, I just gave you a spoiler alert. Just go ahead and praise God now. Right, but that's the God we serve. His plan is going to come to pass. So while the brothers said, let's see what becomes of this dreamer, and they were trying to stop him, they didn't stop a thing. They were used by God to initiate the very thing they were trying to stop. And God knew this already. It wasn't like, oh man, I didn't see that one coming. No, no, he knew that this was going to happen. And so he used their hate and discontent as a part of his plan to initiate the process to see his people preserved through the famine. This is the God we serve. He's not trying to figure it out. He's got it all worked out. Before you even know there's a problem, he's already worked out the solution. 20 years in advance. He's working it all together, and we'll come through the middle of it like, I don't know if this is working. You don't even know what the problem is. God sees, he knows, and he's already responding. That's the God that we serve, and Joseph realizes this. So he says, you sold me. I know you think you did something, but no, you get no credit for what's working out here. God sent me. And not only did God send me with purpose, he raised me up to be in a position of power so that his purpose could come to pass. And the question that I ask you, the same question I ask myself, who doesn't want to partner with a God like that? I mean, with a God who's not forecasting, but with a God who foreknows. And so we can be sure that whatever he says, it will happen. That's why the scriptures tell us his word will not return back to him void. It will accomplish that which he has sent it out to do, because in him it already is. He's not waiting for some new variables to see, ooh, didn't know. No, it already is. And so he initiates the plan. And you know, and I know, and we can rest assured that because God's in it, it is done. With that God, we should jump in and partner with him to see his purpose come to pass, because he makes provision for his people. But if we can be honest, many of us don't feel like we are worthy to partner with God. It's like, Michael, I get it. That's cool. You're absolutely right. I mean, that's a mind-blowing, amazing God. He knows it all. He's not forecasting. He foreknew. Go ahead and hashtag that or make it a post. You know, that is great. Love that. But I'm not Joseph. I'm not Joseph. You know, you don't know what I've been through. You don't know what I've done. And you're right. I don't know what many of you have been through. And I don't know all that you've done, unless you've told me some things. But what I do know is a little bit of Joseph's story. And before we make Joseph out to be some superhero, Joseph comes from what we would consider, and this is probably putting it politely, a dysfunctional family. I'm just going to make it nice. I mean, I think that's nicely put. At a minimum, dysfunction was in his home. He had a father who had favorites. Always a bad idea. He had brothers that hated him to the core, so much so that the consolation was being sold into slavery. Like, oh, well, you are brothers, so we're not going to mess you up too bad. We're just going to sell you. Like, what? That was his household. And Joseph dealt with trauma. Joseph, we didn't read it in this story, but if you read back in Genesis a little bit further, Joseph lost his mother when he was young. So Joseph grew up without his mother, was betrayed by his brothers. I mean, Joseph had some issues that he dealt with. And yet God sees and God knows who Joseph is, where he has been, what he has been through, and God calls Joseph and positions Joseph to partner with him. Our dysfunction doesn't disqualify us from being in partnership with God. And some of you may feel like, oh, well, yeah, well, I'm not Joseph's brothers really in this story, or I'm not Joseph, I'm more like Joseph's brothers. I'm the one that was trying to kill somebody or looking to sell somebody in slavery, betraying someone. And see, if we read the full story and we understand it, you look and see what Joseph says, the promise for preservation wasn't just for Joseph, because Joseph was God's favorite son. God doesn't have favorites. The promise for preservation was for Joseph's brothers as well. Right? So God had a plan to care for Joseph's brothers also. And so it doesn't matter what you've been through. It doesn't matter what you've done. The God who knows all, who knows your beginning and your end, has a desire to partner with you. And we don't have enough information to look at God and try to forecast and say, yeah, but I'm just a failure. No, no, no. The God who knows already says, I want to partner with you. What do I say to that God? You don't know me? Now, as humble as that may try to sound, oh, well, you know, I'm just not worthy. No, that's really me being arrogant. Right? To tell the Creator, you're making a poor choice in picking me. You don't know who I am. What? No, this is what I hear God saying to me, at least not to you. No, you don't know who you are. God knows who we are. He is our Creator. The Bible tells us that He knew our days before we were even formed in our mother's womb. And He calls us to Himself. He's not waiting to figure out some new information. Oh, I didn't see Michael making that decision in his 60s. Threw me off. I never should have picked him. No, He knows. And yet He calls us to Himself. And so none of us in this space, I don't care what you've been through, I don't care what you've done, I don't care how much dysfunction there may be in your past or in your present, you can partner with God because God desires to partner with you. And there's nothing that could separate you from that love that God has for you. All we have to be willing to do is say, yes, Lord, I'll partner with you in your plan. And not to hold up our mess as a block, but to bring our mess and say, God, here you go. Thank you for cleaning this up. Now send me, I will go. That should be our response to the one who knows all, to the one who calls us to Himself. But I'd be remiss if I didn't speak to the truth of the fact that partnering with God doesn't mean a pain-free, pleasant pathway to experiencing the promise. As we see in Joseph's life, the plan was initiated through betrayal, and that hurts. But again, Joseph also declares that not only was he sent, but he was also raised up to the position of power. Now, time won't allow me to go through the whole story, but when you have a chance, I'd say make some time this week to read chapters 39 and just go ahead and read to the end of 50 so you can see Joseph's full story. But 39 through 44 at least will give you a picture of what Joseph's process looked like. And just to sum it up, Joseph was sold into slavery. And when he came into Egypt, he did not say, hey, excuse me, slave traders, I have an appointment with Pharaoh, because I need to be in charge. And so if you could just drop me off right here, I'm just going to mosey up into the palace and let Pharaoh know I'm here, all present and accounted for. Pharaoh, no, that wasn't how the process went. Joseph was sold into slavery, and he was sold into Potiphar's house, the captain of the guard. And the Bible would let us know that the good hand of God was on Joseph's life, and he prospered. The only problem was the good hand of the Lord wasn't the only hand that was on Joseph when he was in Potiphar's house. Joseph's servant or the master's wife had a hand on Joseph as well. And as Joseph was trying to get away from her, because Joseph had integrity in his heart and he would not dishonor God, Potiphar's wife decided to accuse Joseph of trying to take advantage of her. And so now Joseph is thrown into prison for a life sentence, which should have been death. I mean, if a slave tries to take advantage of their master's wife, that's not prison, that's death. But God preserved Joseph because he had a plan and he had a promise that he had to see come through. And so Joseph is put into prison. And then in prison, Joseph, while continuing to serve, because the good hand of the Lord was also on Joseph while he was in prison, he tells the story of the interpretation of a dream of a cupbearer, and the cupbearer is restored back to his rightful place in Pharaoh's house now. And Joseph told the cupbearer, "Don't forget about me. Remember me when you go before Pharaoh, because I don't belong here." But the cupbearer forgot Joseph. And the Bible says for 2 whole years, for 2 whole years, forgotten in prison. And then all of a sudden, Pharaoh has a dream. And the cupbearer's like, "Ah, that's right, Joseph. Oh, now you remember." You see, just Joseph just being neglected. Right? And then Joseph gets called up. And one day he's a prisoner. The next day he's in front of Pharaoh. And he interprets Pharaoh's dream and gives him some counsel. And now Pharaoh puts Joseph into the position of power that he finds himself in this story that we just read over. But that span of time was 13 years. 13 years being sold into slavery, being lied on when you're just trying to do the right thing, and being put back into a pit that was a prison, and then being forgotten about in the prison. And Joseph says that that entire process was a part of God working out his plan to preserve his people. So the process that we go through in partnership with God is not pain-free. But the Lord knows what it takes, not just to see the purpose come to pass, but for us to be able to partner with him. So I don't know what Joseph was going through, and I don't know why Joseph had to go through that. It could be said, and some people have surmised, that Joseph may have been a little bit bratty. You know, because if you know that your brothers hate you, why would you tell them a dream that they're bowing down to you? Are you digging it in and rubbing it in their face? I don't know. But regardless of what position Joseph may have been in, the reality is God knew that this is what Joseph needed to go through. And this is where it may sometimes break down for us, because we'll look and feel like God's not doing what he should do, or God's not doing what we want him to do. But may I remind you that God initiated this plan before we even knew there was a problem. And so how are we now, with our limited ability to forecast, which we can clearly see is oftentimes off, going to look at God and say, "What are you doing? Do you know what the problem is?" "No, but I don't think this is the way you solve it." You don't even know what the problem is. Right? So just trust that the one who has solved the problem, because he already knew, knows exactly what he's doing as he works out the process. And we partner with him. And then we can sing that song that, "Come what may, it is well with my soul," because I'm partnering with a God who is the first and the last, the beginning and the end, the Alpha and the Omega. All things exist in him. Paul would go on to tell us in Romans that all things work together for good for those who love him and who are called according to his purpose. Nobody can stop what God's got. No one can stop it. You can only participate in it, willingly or unwillingly. So come what may, pain, persecution, trial, and challenge, God is faithful and he will provide. And if we believe that, then one could say that, well, we don't have problems either. I always say that a problem states that there's a solution that's needed. But God knows already. So it's not like he's trying to figure out a solution. He already has it all figured out. And if we know this God, how do we walk through the trials and the challenges? What's our perspective when problems arise? Do we look at life through the lens of the pain that has been done to us, through the things that we are enduring, or do we look through the lens of purpose? I don't know all that's going on, and I don't know why, but I know this much, that God has sent me with purpose. And the God who has sent me with purpose also has a process that he is able to perfectly work out to see his promise come to pass. And he will provide for his people so that we do not come to poverty. This is our God. He doesn't just forecast, he already knows. And so it's a surefire thing that his plan will come to pass. And it's in that we find our peace, because we know that God knows, even though we don't know what the future holds. And so if you know this God, I want to encourage you, if you believe in this God, that you trust him, that you trust him in the midst of your pit experience, that you trust him in the midst of betrayal, that you trust him in the midst of being lied on, wrongfully accused, being imprisoned on trumped up charges, that you trust him when you feel like everybody has forgotten about you, that you trust him because he's faithful, and that if this is the process that he has decided to initiate to see his promise come to pass, he knows what he's doing. And I know it may not look like it's going to rain, but take your umbrella, because God called for showers. But I'm so grateful that he also calls for sunshine. Right? So if you know this God, then we find peace in that space. If you don't know God this way, please, hear me well. God knows you. And there's nothing that you have said, there's nothing that you have done, there's nothing that has been done to you that is enough to keep God's love from you. God, this is the God that we serve. Even knowing in our sinful state how messy we were, he would initiate his plan to send his only begotten son to die for us while we were yet in a position to really not have any desire to be partnered with. And he would send his son to die for our sins. And I love how the story goes, right? Because people like Judas and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, Pilate and the Roman officials, they thought that they could stop the process. But all they were doing was propelling God to fulfill his purpose. They were unwilling participants in the promise that God made to solve sin. And so now, because Jesus was willing to die for our sins, we don't have to stay stuck in sin. We can now come to him. And so if you don't know Jesus, you can still partner with him, because he knows you. And he loves you, and he wants to be in relationship with you. Who doesn't want to partner with a God like that? And I even hear, as I'm looking to wind down, that there are some of us who believe, but we need to be reminded, because we can find ourselves beating ourselves up, right? We've come to Christ because we know that he loves us. But somewhere along the way, something happened. Somebody did something to you, or you did something. And it's much easier to hide, to be ashamed, to beat ourselves up, and to forget that God didn't rescue you because he thought you were going to be perfect from now until the day he calls you home. No, God rescued you knowing your future. He knew already that you'd mess up again. Right? He's no more surprised at our mess ups than a parent is surprised when a kid who's learning how to walk trips and falls. Like, I can't believe you fell. I just started walking yesterday. Right? You put cushions up. You expect the fall to come. Right? God is not surprised. He says, you know what, son? That's okay. Get back up and let's go. Right? And some of us need to hear that today. Get up. Get up. Don't just stay there. Don't stay there like God doesn't know. He knew already. He is the first and the last, the beginning and the end. He knew what you would do today, and he knows what you'll do 10 years from now. And even knowing all that you'll do from now until the day he calls you home, he still says, I love you, and nothing can separate you from my love. I'm telling you, we as believers should be some of the most carefree people in the history of mankind. Like, Michael, you just spilled all that milk. Ah, no, let me clean it up. All right, now let's go. I mean, you know, like, oh man, I spilled all the milk, and now I'm just, you know, don't cry over spilled milk. Like, clean it up and let's go. Right? Let's keep going. We shouldn't stay stuck. Not when we know this God, this way. Partner with him. Don't let pain and persecution keep you from coming to God. When you know that no matter what we go through, hear me, it's guaranteed. It's guaranteed that we win. The Lord has made a promise. He's made a promise to us all that if we trust and obey, we will be with him in eternity. He says, in my Father's house are many rooms. And if I go to prepare a place for you, then I will return to come and get you again. And he says, in that place, no pain, no tears. He says, in this place called earth, there will be pain, there will be tears. But don't worry, I've overcome this place, and I've got a place for you where there's no pain and no tears. I mean, if we believe that today, right, how do we walk into that? How do we come to God through that with a joy that says, I know God's got a promise for me. And so this is not a problem for him. Right? And so we can trust him and we can have a peace. So I pray that you come to know this eternal, all-knowing, unchanging, self-sufficient, self-existent, and all these attributes that we've been talking about, that we come to know this God in a very real way. Because if we do, then we partner with him with no problem, knowing that he provides and he will make sure that we don't come to poverty, but that we enter into the promised land.